Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners are warned the following may contain names and voices of deceased persons.
We found a bowerbird nest, and in that bowerbird nest were some knuckles, of human knuckles.
Flood time is when people disappear.
There was big mob of lies been said about him, you know. His body was already finished. In the bag, body bag.
Policeman looked at you, Jimmy, and he said, "What for?" And I said, "I think for that woman, you know." And he said, "Oh, I never touch him."
Jai Boro Nyiganga. Ngayo Imaruwara man and Ngai Mandajara Nyiganga Nyiganga.
This is Wrong Skin, an investigation into a suspicious death and a missing person in the Australian outback. I'm Richard Baker, a journalist with the Melbourne Age, Australia. We've heard from Luma locals about how Julie Buck and Richard Milgan went missing in the wet season of 1994, and from the detective whose job it was to find out what happened after Julie's body was found 10 months later. It was a tough investigation. People were scared to talk. No cause of death could be established for Julie, and there were not enough police to handle all that was going on in the Kimberley. But now, parts of the story are surfacing. We know Julie was promised to an older man, but in defiance, she continued seeing her young boyfriend, Richard. Theirs was a forbidden relationship under traditional kinship rules. With the first two episodes out, it's fair to say this podcast has got people talking, especially in Western Australia. I've already been contacted about two other unconnected, suspicious and unsolved deaths. One's of an elder who disappeared in the Kimberley's flood time, and another case is in a remote mining town further south. And someone in Luma has come forward with a recollection of Richard being threatened by a group of older men out the front of the local shop. This wasn't too long before he and Julie vanished. I was told Richard was warned, "Stop seeing that girl or we'll kill you." So the big question is, was what happened to Richard and Julie bad luck, tribal retribution that got way out of hand, or the result of plain jealousy?
His painting was placed in the midst of a gallery we called Billabong Dreams.
That's Pam McCluskey.
I'm the curator of African and Oceanic art at the Seattle Art Museum.
The old man Julie Buck was promised to and living with when she died. He's probably the most famous person to come from Luma.
And then you looked over at Jimmy's work, and it's a gorgeous color of blue-green background with the serpent that is just kind of twisting its body to protect the waterhole. And the notion of that awareness of the living landscape, and that it has these bodies within it that Australian Aboriginal artists are trying to get us to recognize how sacred that landscape can be.
One Seattle publication listed Jimmy's painting as one of the city's 10 must-see bits of art, along with an Andy Warhol painting.
And the twisting and turning of this serpent body as a protector of the waterhole was just like a magnet for people. And something in the way that he enacted that on canvas just drew you to it. It was abstract initially, but then once you read what the intention was, it switched. So then we had the experience of many people saying they'd look at it, it looks abstract, but then they'd read what it was about, and that notion of a serpent who is saying, "This is a waterhole worth protecting," came alive.
You can see this painting on the Wrong Skin website. There's also a collection of his works in Amsterdam and private owners in Germany and the UK. In Australia, Jimmy's paintings are displayed at the National Gallery in Canberra and at the National Gallery of Victoria in Melbourne. At the age of 11, Jimmy Nerima didn't know the rest of the world existed. Barefoot and barely clothed, he lived with his family in the Great Sandy Desert, 600 kilometres south of Luma. They move from waterhole to waterhole. In his Walmajari tongue, they're called Jila, and they'd become Jimmy's muse. Jimmy told the Sydney Morning Herald he first met white people at Christmas Creek Cattle Station in 1940. The paper ran a story on him ahead of an art exhibition. He said drought and fire were the main reasons desert people came to the stations. Jimmy went through traditional lore, that's L-O-R-E, lore. This process can take years and involves being taken to special parts of country by senior men of his tribe to learn ceremony, stories and ancient song cycles that would bind him to that landscape. Later, he found work as a stockman at the 203,000-hectare Nerima Station, south of the Fitzroy River. The station name became his surname.
Just hang on, mate. This is bad, I know. I'll have to... There's a fucking truck here, hang on. I'm trying to get into a good spot here outside.
I can hear you well.
Yeah. But I just got to get out of the mosquitoes. I was outside and the fucking mosquitoes were biting me. But I'll walk over towards to the roadhouse.
Okay.
And I'll... But you can speak to me like as we go.
Yeah, you sound good.
Up, but I'll get a better reception over there. I'd imagine every other bastard talks on the phone over there, so...
Owen Froggy Finger is a former Queensland rugby player who spent the best part of 50 years running and owning Kimberley cattle stations. He's a knockabout white bloke who knows pretty much everyone in the Kimberley. Jimmy Nerima used to do a few jobs for him from time to time. In early 1995, Froggy was on the road when he bumped into the police.
So I was going over to Luma to pick up some of those folks that were working for me. And they asked me, had I seen Jimmy Nerima? And I said, no, I hadn't. You know? I asked him what it was about, and they said, oh, they want to talk to him in connection with that, you know, that is, that, the bones.
Some young Aboriginal blokes were working with Froggy at the time. Away from the eyes and ears of the powerful senior men, the young fellas were telling Froggy that Julie didn't die of natural causes.
No, it was, don't worry, no one thought it was a mistake, you know. Those boys, they were talking about the same thing at the same time.
Yeah. His take on it, though, was like it was foul play.
Oh, that'd be calling it, you know, sweet instead of sour. So, you know how that show works. You know, up over the range there, I saw horrific fights over that same, you know, it's the age-old thing, isn't it? Lust and fucking whatever.
Last episode, Detective Laspina told us that no one in Luma was talking about what happened to Julie and Richard, or who might have been involved. Senior Luma man, Joe Killer, told us how Julie was living at Jimmy's house at the time of her death. But he also remembered how Richard couldn't keep away from her. There's little doubt in the lead-up to Julie and Richard's disappearance, the pair's relationship was troubling some of the older men.
And anyway... The middle of the night, Jimmy Nerima came banging my door. And I opened the door and I said, hey, well, what? Where is she? And I'm like, who's who? Oh, where, Julie? Where you hide her? And I said, nobody here, and it's just me and the kids.
Julie's best friend, Lisa Skinner, says there was another man, a man with a short fuse and quick fists, with Jimmy that night. We'll get on to him later. Lisa says both men were carrying traditional weapons and looked like they meant business.
Well, you can just go right through my house. I had to open all the doors because the house was, you got bedroom on this side, you got another bedroom and just an open veranda. And I said, well, just go through. And she not here, nobody here. And then... They turned around and said, well, if we're going to find her hanging around with you again, we're gonna end up flogging you. I'm like, go on, you do it, and I'll get the police on you.
Julie's big brother, Graham Bodie, understands why his sister might have been making herself scarce.
The old man will sit there and just order around like a slave, you know what I mean? Make me tea or go and put a billy on or go and do
it. He thinks a younger wife would be expected to do all the work around the house. You know?
So they can be fed and be looked after, more or less.
Now, normally a dead girlfriend and a missing boyfriend would point investigators in Richard's direction. But not a single person I've spoken to thinks Richard was responsible. He loved Julie, and there's no doubt they wanted to be together. This explains why the police wanted to talk to the cuckolded Jimmy Narumma.
And I saw him, and I said to him, well, you know, the policeman looking for you, Jimmy, and he said, what for? And I said, I think for that woman, you know. And he said, oh, I never touched him.
Froggy believed Jimmy's claim of innocence. While Julie was living at his house in Luma, Jimmy also had his first wife, Polly, by his side. Froggy has a pretty simple reason for not suspecting Jimmy.
And he, like, Jimmy Narumma was, you know, they call it vision impaired, but really is, he's fucking blind, you know, pretty much. Like, he could see probably 8 or 10 feet from my, that's how I, anyway. So I wondered how the hell he could have done it personally, I mean.
But Froggy reckons the other man who came to Lisa Skinner's house with Jimmy to look for Julie that night might be in a position to shed some more light on what happened.
You know, like he had those people pretty much where he wanted them. You know, he like, they were dead scared of him too.
Jimmy Narumma died in 2013. The photos I've seen of him show a short, thin bloke with white hair, a huge smile, and black Roy Orbison-style glasses. In Luma, I spoke to several people privately, and they all said Jimmy was sad after Julie was confirmed dead. One woman told me he confided in her that he couldn't stop what was coming her way. He was apparently philosophical about Julie and Richard's relationship. He summed it up as, new generation, new rules. There's others, though, who reckon Jimmy might know a bit about what happened. When Julie Buck disappeared and then was found dead 11 months later, it was Jimmy Narumma's wife, Polly, who looked after her young daughter, Zaria. Jimmy also played a big role in growing up Zaria and apparently used to make her laugh. Zaria has confided in those close to her that Jimmy was nothing but kind to her mum and herself. So while it was natural for police to want to question Jimmy about Julie's death, everyone I've spoken to believes the blame lies elsewhere.
First of all, jaidai buru nyiga na nganga. Ngayo imaru wara manen, ngay manda jara nyiga na nganga. Mabu bayan, mabu lian. Jaidai buru nyiga na. So in my Nyigina language, what I said is, welcome to Nyigina country.
Thank you for having us.
This is, and my introduction is, as I said, Ngajunu Nilawala Ann Paulina. Ngayo Immadawara Manan. So my name is Ann Paulina, and in my language, what I said is, I belong to the river. So in terms of property rights, I am a guardian and a custodian of the river, and my due diligence and my duty of care is to make sure this river, we call it Immarawara, and make sure that this river is here for generations to come. I think what's really unique about this Fitzroy River is that it was National Heritage listed in 2011, which means that this is a river that belongs to all Australians and if not, indeed the world. So it's a very special place. It's especially, it has big meaning.
We were lucky enough to spend a night on a small cattle station at the start of the wet season that belongs to Ann Paulina and her husband Ian. With a PhD in biodiversity and a passion for her environment, Ann is respected and known right around Australia. You can see the most incredible sunrises from their 25 metre high water tank stand. Ann's station's not too far from Luma. Her love and connection with country is obvious and emblematic of a feeling right across the Kimberley.
So they said the law came from the stars. So that's really important, and then how the law travels. But most importantly, the law is in the land. We have a song cycle, we have a law called Wallangari Law. Wallangari Law is the law for the river. It's the rules for the river in terms of how human beings act with non-human beings. And we call the river, River of Life, Marawara. So that's why it is so sacred. It is a living ancestral being. It is not a human being. It's an ancestral being.
One of the best things I experienced in the Kimberley was the generosity of its people. They want to share their environment and history, not just with me, but anyone who's open to listening.
Right, that's the way I'm doing it.
Around Luma, it all comes back to the river.
People one day know, oh, we are going to Luma. Can we go river? That's the only thing you'll hear, river. Because this time of year is hot, so
river.
That's Wayne Watson, Richard Milgan's boyhood friend. The two of them were working on a cattle station together before Richard and Julie disappeared. When Wayne Watson comes to the river in his beat-up old red Land Cruiser, he's noticeably more relaxed. It's as if his problems, for the time being at least, have gone away.
This is where we, in another world. And it's peaceful now, this river. It's the best thing for us, mother. Like today, we still got it, but we want our kids to have it now. But at the moment now, you know, they got Facebook. They're getting into trouble, young marriages. Then they're buying a car, but they're using it to go to town instead of come out here and, you know, live off the land. Not only them kids, we got a younger one that's, they drink more than what we went through. They even look older than us.
Wayne shares a few things in common with Julie Buck. A love of the river and fishing, a fondness for Richard, and marrying young.
And I was married to one of the girl there. She was only 14. A school girl.
And she was like your promise?
Yeah, that's it. They gave me when she was 2 years old. But that's in 85 now. And I brought her back here, and she learned our side, and I learned their side. Until today, she's still my best mate, and I still have that respect. They have that same respect.
Though they're no longer together, Wayne's affection for his first wife is obvious. He showed me photos on his phone of his kids and grandkids and his first wife, his best mate. His looks like a good family. It shows that some promise relationships turn out well. Talk to Wayne for long enough and you'll find that he's big on respect. So is Anne Paulina.
And it was a law based on collective wisdom where people...
She remembers a time when respect for the laws, respect for the land and respect for each other seemed more prevalent in the Kimberley than they are today.
People came together, and I remember this as a child. When I was very young, I travelled around into the country all around here, up to all the different stations, because my father, after he built the Derby Jetty, then started to work with my uncle, and we'd go around fixing all the windmills.
Her memory takes her to the place Joe Killer's dad thought was a good spot for a community, the place now called Luma. It was a meeting place back then.
People would just come, hundreds and hundreds of people would come and sort out business, and people had to be punished or something was gone wrong. People had to stand and bring their witnesses and be accountable. So yeah, so all of those things brought together an exchange of knowledge and exchange of justice.
For lots of reasons, Anne and Wayne believe respect and accountability aren't what they used to be in the Kimberley. I don't think what they're feeling is nostalgia. Maybe it's because the wisest old people are now long gone. Maybe it's as simple as greed, spurred on by white man's native title laws. Whatever it is, there's a sense of disorder in the Kimberley right now. It's like the laws of the land have been distorted.
Some that call themselves senior lawmen grabbing something that's not his or not hers. People say this is the oldest culture. And look what we're doing, going against each other. Everybody see a big picture of Australia and the oldest culture. But the inside, no. We're going fighting against ourselves.
Well, I think something that came in that seemed to have corrupted the world I knew as a five-year-old travelling through country and travelling in country and travelling with country. And so in my lifetime, particularly in the last 30 years, I've just seen that some of the way, particularly some of the men act, who have to some extent made themselves the law and almost seen themselves above other people in the community, whether they're male or female, is that this sort of changed quite considerably when people started to see how they could have power to dominate other people. And so, yeah, and it's not a... I wouldn't say that it's a thing of men. No. It's a thing of men who have been corrupted by power, this phenomenon of power. Because once you have it, it's a bit like people who are really wealthy. It's like the more they've got, the more they want, and that seems to create within them a dark side, but gives them power, gives them privilege, gives them the ability to manipulate and destroy other people.
A new Toyota Troop Carrier is among the most prized of possessions in the Kimberley. They're a long wheelbase, four-wheel drive, which seat 11 people, but regularly carry a lot more out here. One of these will take you safely where most other vehicles cannot, and if you get stranded, they'll keep you alive for longer. But Richard and Julie didn't have access to one of these. They were on foot when they were last seen.
And she ran.
And they were in a hurry.
No, they was running in a billabong from Upliveringa, Lowliveringa.
The grand old lady, Lucy Marshall, remembers seeing Richard and Julie moving quickly and looking stressed.
Running with a biggest swag.
Richard's brother, Wayne Milgan, also remembers the couple leaving in a rush.
One late night, they came in, got a water bottle, and I remember they took off with my dad's hat and a lighter. They were like for matches or lighter, and they took off.
They must have found them.
The story I've been told by several people is there was one, possibly two cars full of men who'd been chasing them around.
I brought them back in the car.
But it's a troop carrier everyone talks about.
They had a brown Toyota. And they were alive, I think. After they took them there to that, in between that hill.
So they came back from wherever they were. Yeah, they got to Derby or...
They found them, you know, they took off from here.
Yep.
They traced the tracks and everything, find them where they are. First of all, they probably must have damaged his leg from running away, you know. They was making them suffer, you know.
Richard Milgan was 24, yeah. Just under 6 feet tall, and built like a heavyweight boxer. He wouldn't have been easy to take down. Another reason to discount the small, near-blind and 70-year-old Jimmy Nerima as a sole suspect, at least.
How would they have damaged his leg?
I don't know, I didn't see it, but the way he should have had a mark here in the side, spear mark.
Remember though, pathologists couldn't give a cause of death for Julie. Her skeleton gave no clues to any injuries. So we don't know if Julie and Richard were speared, as Joe Killer suggests. If they were, then it would have been by a group of senior men who, rightly or wrongly, believed themselves to be the enforcers of the law derived from the land, a law that forbade wrong skin relationships.
And then this other old lady, she was drunk, she was talking, and, you know, some people, they like to talk when they're drunk.
Lisa's telling me about the time an old Luma lady loosened up after a few drinks and started talking about what she saw in the days after Richard and Julie were last seen alive.
Blood everywhere in the car, and he had men, big mob of men in the car, and I was asking them for cigarette, but they didn't give me. And she thought there was fresh meat under the tarp.
But they'd been hunting or something?
Yeah. No, there's some fresh meat. What give us fresh meat? But they didn't want to move, and they said, no, you get away, go. But she reckoned the smell wasn't good, you know. And then I said, well, what you guys been do? I'm walking out, because they pushed me away.
What happened next with this particular Toyota is pretty weird.
I said, hey, how come the Toyota got the same number plate but different colour? Can they do that? Just thinking to myself. Because I had a photo of that Toyota when it was brown, and then come back and find it blue. And I said, what the hell?
The Toyota Troopy was taken to a garage in Derby and sprayed a different colour. It was then given a thorough clean for good measure, according to a man who worked there at the time. Detectives from the Cold Case Homicide Squad recently found the Toyota on what's said to be traditional law ground, a short drive from Luma. Time and harsh weather have likely ruined any forensic value. But finding out who the car was registered to back in 1994 turns up something that will shake the Kimberley to its core. Next time on Wrong Skin.
Because they're a big man in a land control way, you know. They're real trusty people, you know. But behind that, they're different. They're not as good as what you think, you know.
And we're dealing with traditional owners all the time. And I mean, you know, it's the same old thing. The old foot soldiers are all good blokes. It's only the generals who are the pricks, you know.
Because they hit him everywhere with stick from head to foot. They had to get a piece of bone from the back of his skull to join it up here.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review Wrong Skin on iTunes. And if you know more about this story, email Richard Baker, rbaker@fairfaxmedia.com.au. Wrong Skin is investigated and presented by Richard Baker and produced by Rachel Dexter and Tim Young. The executive producer is Greg Mueller, Tom McKendrick is head of video and audio, and Dr. Siobhan McHugh is consulting producer.